integrity in each of the services is also critical to a strong military. General Amos, I have become friends with Major James Wyrick, United States Marine Corps, who I sincerely believe is a man of integrity. Did you fear Major Wyrick at any point?
My name is James Wyrick, and this is Military Justice, my podcast about the system of justice that governs those who protect our nation. Welcome back to Military Justice, and thank you for joining us again. Today is a little bit different type of an episode, but I am very sure that you're going to enjoy it. In this episode, I play a portion of another project that I'm involved in, which is the podcast Cold Traces. I'm joining Christina, the host of Cold Traces, for her second season, and she is telling the story of the unsolved murder of David Cox. Before David Cox was murdered, he was in the Marine Corps. And during his time in the Marine Corps, he was involved in a hazing incident in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. The details of that incident were portrayed in the film A Few Good Men. This is a fascinating story and one that I was unaware of until Christina brought it to my attention. It's a pleasure to be involved in this. So please go to Cold Traces and subscribe to her podcast, and also you can listen to her first season. It's also a very compelling story. So in this episode, I talked to Christina about the events that occurred in Guantanamo Bay that led up to the events prior to David Cox's murder. I hope you'll enjoy it, and with no further ado, here's the episode.
Hey guys, welcome back to the Cold Traces podcast. This is the fourth episode of Season 2, Justice for David Cox. Today's episode is a very special episode. It's really a standalone episode, so if you haven't listened to the previous ones yet, that's okay today. We've been spending a lot of time digging into the details around David Cox's time in the military, and I promise we are going to move into talking about the details around his murder and the theories around who might be responsible. But I think today's episode will really drive home the point around why understanding David Cox's connection to the Marine Corps is so important, and how a thorough understanding of that can provide some insight and context into what might have happened to him. About a week ago, I had the absolute pleasure of speaking with James Wyrick, better known simply by his last name as Wyrick. Wyrick is a retired Marine Lieutenant Colonel, judge advocate, and lawyer, and he's also the host of the Military Justice Podcast. If you've never heard of the Military Justice Podcast, make sure to search for that in Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening to this podcast. It's so well done. Wyrick has a lot of really great interviews, and it's very informative and topical. For example, the most recent episodes go into detail on what's happening in the Bo Bergdahl case. Also, Wyrick is just a really great guy. He's sharing part of our conversation today over on the Military Justice Podcast, and then sending his listeners over to Cold Traces because he wants to help bring more attention to David Cox's case. So let's show him some love back and go download and subscribe the Military Justice Podcast. One other quick note before we get to the conversation with Wyrick. So there was a little bit of a delay on my end on my connection with Wyrick in today's conversation, and it took me a little bit of time to realize what was happening, which is why you may hear us interrupting each other in odd places or why my responses might seem a little bit delayed. I tried to clean all of that up as much as possible in post, but if you hear some of that, now you know why. Please excuse it. Okay, without any further ado, let's get to my conversation with Wyrick, host of the Military Justice Podcast. Thank you so much, Wyrick, for agreeing to speak with me. The case that I'm covering for this season has a lot of military aspects to it, and I personally don't have a military connection or have much knowledge of the military in general, so I wanted to bring in an expert to talk about the details and get some context and insight into the case. So if you need a military expert in the podcast world, you go to Wyrick. So thank you.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed your first season, and I'm already definitely enjoying the second season here with David's story. And it twice in my career, I was sent to Guantanamo Bay, and I've spent a number of years either down there or in between DC and down there. So I know a good amount about both Guantanamo Bay and a little bit about this case. If you can see in one of the photographs of David's lawyer, there's another military lawyer in that photograph, and that's David Iglesias, retired Navy captain, and he was my boss for a number of years and a man I think very highly of. So I think he's one of the number of true life people that were the inspiration for Tom Cruise's character in A Few Good Men.
Right. And he's like the person standing in the middle of that photograph. Is that right?
Yes. It seems that the Navy kind of chose all their best looking JAGs to be on this case because he's the handsome guy right in the middle. Yes. They definitely...
Don Mercari, who I spoke to for the last episode, was one of the lawyers that perhaps was the inspiration for the Tom Cruise character, but there were maybe two or three others who were also involved in that case, so I don't want to pretend like they weren't a part of it too.
Oh, no, definitely. I think that, at least from what I've heard, that Tom Cruise character is kind of an amalgam of a number of the lawyers.
Right, right. And just for the benefit of your listeners, if they're listening and they don't know anything about this case, I'll just briefly give a little bit of background on what happened and why we're talking about this.
Oh, please do.
So this season on Cold Traces, I'm covering the story of David Cox, who was killed when he was just 27 years old in 1994. And the reason we're talking about Guantanamo Bay and lawyers is that David's experiences as a Marine stationed in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, were depicted in the 1992 film A Few Good Men. After that movie was released, David was pretty outspoken about what really happened in Gitmo and the differences between the movie and what he actually experienced. And David, along with a few of his fellow Marines, was even planning to file a lawsuit against the filmmakers, but David's plans were put permanently on hold because shortly before that lawsuit was actually filed, he disappeared from his home in Natick, Massachusetts. And then 3 months later, his body was discovered. He had been shot from behind once in the base of the neck and then three times in the left side of the torso. So he was killed from behind, basically execution style. Okay, so Wyrick, as you said, you actually spent a little time down in Gitmo. Can you tell me about that and what it's like down there?
So I was there after David was down there. The first time I was down there was 2004, and then again for a few years in 2008. It's a strange little place. It is, I describe it as a small chunk of the Nevada desert stuck in the middle of the Caribbean. Guantanamo Bay itself, the base, doesn't get much rainfall. In fact, almost no rainfall at all. And that kind of played into the Cold War battle that went on there, that at one time Fidel Castro cut off the water supply in the, I think, late 1960s to Guantanamo Bay, and they had to build a desalinization plant. And it is still, even to this day, it's still, or it might be a little bit different now that in the last year or so, but even when I was there, there's still the mirrors or the other centuries. You could see them across probably about a half mile. But you could, just with the unaided eye, you could still see the Soviet-style towers. And there were, for every one of our towers, there was another Cuban tower across the way. And then there was, in between that, a no-man's land of landmines and fencing. And so it was still, it still has a definite feel of, you know, the Cold War down there.
It's pretty isolated, but yeah.
Probably back then, maybe 2,000 total people in Guantanamo Bay, something like that, and then 500 or so Marines. And they were just, the Marines are just responsible for that security around the perimeter. But you could see even throughout the base, you know, probably dating back to the 60s. I mean, there are entrenched positions. There are dugout areas for fighting positions and places where they would put machine guns. I mean, it was, you can definitely see the remnants of really thought out defense of that area. You know, the idea that it's not, it was on everybody's mind that it's possible that the Cubans would try to, you know, try to attack.
Right. So it was still a little tense.
Definitely. Those Marines, and still those Marines there are, that's not an easy duty.
Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what David was doing down there. And you actually knew one of the lawyers, as you said, who represented one of the other Marines who was involved in this whole hazing incident. Did he tell you about or this incident, or had you heard about it from, you know, the movie coming out or in other ways?
Well, I don't think it's a stretch to say that any Marine or Navy JAG or, you know, judge advocate of my age group, you know, mid 40s, we had all grown up watching A Few Good Men. I mean, I have based at least my entire professional career on watching that movie. And, you know, that's just something that we had all seen and, you know, could quote from. So I definitely asked Captain Iglesias about it a number of times. And he told me quite a bit about it. And he also, you know, as your listeners know, it didn't quite happen. William T. Santiago didn't, you know, that character dies in A Few Good Men, but the actual person didn't die in reality. So it differed a little, but he said Captain Iglesias said that it stood up pretty well as far as being factual.
My understanding is it was pretty close. It was fairly aligned with what happened in the true story. As you said, the guy did not die in real life. He was medevaced off the island, I believe, to Miami, and he recovered. And then the other big difference that David was kind of upset about, well, I think he was upset that he thought that Downey and Dawson maybe were kind of doofuses. I don't think he thought that they portrayed him and the other Marines in the best light. I don't know if I agree with that. But the other main thing that he was really upset about was that in the movie they got a dishonorable discharge, but in real life David was honorably discharged. He got to finish out his service, and he was found guilty of simple assault and got time served, but he did get an honorable discharge.
Yeah, that's, as again, when I first saw A Few Good Men, I thought it was the greatest thing ever. And then when you practice law for a while in the military, you're like, oh my gosh, there's so many things wrong with this. And one of those being, you know, that they were discharged with a dishonorable discharge. And yes, in reality, David received an honorable discharge. And it might not sound like a big difference, but there's, between dishonorable and honorable, there are at least three gradients in between. So to get an honorable discharge, that means that's a huge gulf between there and a dishonorable. So I could see why that would be very upsetting to David, because dishonorable, very few people get kicked out with that. You really have to do something, a pretty heinous act, to get a dishonorable discharge. And from what I've seen, at least, so David goes from Guantanamo Bay and then serves again in Panama. And so it seems, and I would have to look at the records to for sure know this, but it seems like that would have required him to re-enlist. So that means that the Marine Corps accepted him for another term of enlistment. So I could see where that would definitely upset him because they're portraying him as being, although he's drummed out of the service when he, in reality, was allowed to continue to serve in other positions, even after his time in Guantanamo Bay.
Right. So how long are those enlistments?
Generally, 3.5 years. I mean, there can be some differences depending on a person's military occupation, but generally 3.5 years at a clip.
Okay. Yeah, because he did go on and serve, I believe, 2.5 more years in the Marines. And like you said, he went down to Panama where he was involved in Operation Just Cause, which was the operation that resulted in the arrest of Noriega, I believe.
Yes. Having gone through sniper school and being an infantry Marine and serving in Guantanamo Bay and then being sent down to Panama, that he was a hard-charging, tip-of-the-spear Marine, that he wasn't some, guy in the rear. That's definitely, to have those assignments in the mid-80s, he definitely was the cream of the crop.
Right. Yeah, that's kind of, good to hear, because that's been my impression, so it's good to hear you say that. He was the assistant squad leader. He stated in one of the newspaper articles that he gave after the movie came out that he was a part of kind of the group of the 10 best Marines down in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba at that time, and he said they only really let the best Marines in that group, the most loyal ones, the ones that were in the best physical conditions, and they worked under the base, directly under the base colonel and the company captain. So it's good to hear you say that and kind of confirm that.
Yeah, he definitely seems like one of those fire and forget type of Marines, one that didn't have to be looked after, one that was just always squared away and was really just counted on to do important jobs. And you can see that from his future service down in Panama. It's not like we were just sending nobodies down there. That was definitely, one of the very few hot spots going on in the 80s as far as, direct action with the enemy. So we would have definitely been sending our best down there.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that gives some good insight into not only what happened down in Gitmo and the, with the hazing that he was involved in and perhaps why he was involved in that, but also why he decided, they offered these 10 Marines involved in this hazing, they offered them an other than honorable discharge. They could just go home and take that. But David and two others said, no, we were following orders and we're going to go to court, even though they were facing, decades in jail. They were facing attempted murder charges.
Right, which he was later convicted of the lesser included offense of simple assault. And to go off on a, not too much of a tangent, I hope, but I, as a defense attorney in the Marine Corps, that was one of my assignments, and I had a client very similar to David. He was a sergeant who was a tanker. He drove tanks, and he was charged with hazing because he had spent, two tours in Iraq, and then he was back and had a young Marine who was not that squared away, in his unit. And the accusations were, not quite as physical as what happened in the Guantanamo Bay case, but that he was forcing this Marine to do push-ups and calisthenics and, yelling at him, etc. And that, if I'm honest, was the most heart-wrenching of my cases. When we were waiting for that verdict, it was the most difficult for me. Luckily, we got an acquittal, but I can see how the lawyer in this case, Don, right?
Yep. Mm-hmm. Don Marcari.
Yeah, Don Marcari. I could see how he developed a friendship with David, because that sergeant that I worked with, we're not condoning hazing, but these people that are doing this are doing it to try to make that other Marine better. I mean, my client definitely had seen people die in Iraq, numerous people, and knew that if this, the person that he was accused of hazing, if that person didn't get squared away, that he could, it would cost him his and possibly other Marines' lives. So there is something about the handling a case of some of a Marine or any other service member who's accused of hazing that you develop more of a bond with them because they're definitely your better or some of your best Marines that may have just taken it too far. So I could see why Don and David kind of developed that bond.
Before I move on to, like, after the whole Gitmo situation and after his time in the military, is there anything else that you wanted to point out about that whole time period?
Well, I think one thing that I can put myself in David's shoes a little bit, because I had this happen with another client, and I had it happen to a certain extent in my career, where you come into the Marine Corps with very idealistic views of the world. Mm-hmm. And then it seems like, and you could see it happen in David's case, that, you know, you have such reverence for superior officers. And it seems like the battalion commander, the colonel that later becomes Nathan R. Jessup, you know, as portrayed by Jack Nicholson, that he all of a sudden doesn't have any, that he doesn't remember what he may have said previously, that the William Santiago character, you know, could have been shipped off earlier, but wasn't, and then later forgets about all of that. So I can feel for David in that he had such an idealized version of the Marine Corps and senior officers. And then when that changes, or you find out that's not the case, it really stays with you. It's something hard to get over. And I think that stayed with him probably for the rest of the time he was in the Marine Corps, and definitely it tainted his view of the Marine Corps after he was out.
Yeah, I think that's definitely a good point. I think he did, you know, his family told me he did have plans to have a military career. And after that whole incident, it did kind of tarnish his views a little bit, because that colonel never admitted what he said. So I think it definitely changed David and David's plans for the future.
Right, that he, you know, he had been led to believe that, well, you know, that everyone would tell the absolute truth at all times, and you find out sometimes that that's not the case. And really, it's not about the Marine Corps. The Marine Corps I still love, but realizing that there are individuals that are human, and we sometimes find that out in less than perfect ways, and it seems that happened in David's career also.
Right, and I think it ruined the career of that colonel. I mean, I've heard that there may have been some other things going on with this colonel, but I'm not positive. But basically, after that, he was sent back to Camp Lejeune. He was sent packing back to Camp Lejeune.
Yeah, I'm not sure either on that one. But maybe somebody figured out that they could see through the... maybe it didn't come out in the court-martial, but it doesn't seem like the colonel was absolutely above reproach with the way he handled this. Although that's always, sure. You know, so, it's a great part of the movie, A Few Good Men, when Nathan R. Jessup, you know, gets up and says, you effed with the wrong Marine and has to be restrained. But you don't really see that happen in a court-martial. They're never quite as juicy as that. Very, very few people come off the witness stand, and, you know, in ready to fight. But it made for, I'll tell you.
You've never had quite such a...
No, Aaron Sorkin, he sure can write he sure can write, because he makes it a lot more interesting than it is in real life.
Yeah, it's an amazing movie. I mean, I understand why David was upset, but I think he said that in one of the articles he was quoted in when the movie came out, he said, If I hadn't known the true story, it probably would have been the best movie I'd seen in my life. So even he had to admit that it's a really good movie.
Yeah, and if any of your listeners haven't seen it, it holds up well. I mean, it's aged well. It's what now, 25 years old at least, but it's still anytime it's on TNT or something, and I'm flipping through the channels, I'll have to stop and watch it.
Yeah, I bought it after hearing about this case and rewatched it, and you're right, it really holds up well. And I actually heard they're doing like a live TV version of it. I don't know if you've heard that, but we'll see.
Ooh, maybe don't tamper with that. But I don't know. Sorkin always does pretty good stuff.
Yeah, the movie, I think, can't be beat, in my opinion. But anyway. So after the Marine Corps, David, he got out and he went back home. He settled in Natick, Massachusetts, which he's from Needham, but these are all just small towns outside of Boston, so he wasn't far from his home. And he kind of was just starting his life over again, working odd jobs and taking some classes. And so then that's when the movie A Few Good Men came out. And that's when he started speaking with the media. He was speaking with newspapers. He did a radio interview. And like we mentioned, he was considering joining this a lawsuit against Aaron Sorkin and against Castle Rock Entertainment, I believe. And he was really pretty outspoken. I mean, he's a pretty extroverted guy. And he did talk about some of the stuff that went down in Guantanamo Bay. So I don't know what you think about all that. Is this common, or is this kind of a no-no? Like, you shouldn't be talking about the things that happened that may or may not have been outside of appropriate or for the military, I guess.
I mean, I was involved in a case with some snipers urinating on bodies in Afghanistan, and I've come to know some of them. And kind of known some of the people around them. And it's a different time now because of the presence of social media. But I can tell you that they're definitely, in cases like that, you'll have a split. You'll have some people that are so dedicated to the Marine Corps that anybody that speaks ill of the Corps, they're going to be mad at. And then, you know, there's all obviously also some supporters, but I could see him, I mean, in getting at least some pushback from individuals that believe that because him saying these things that it's tarnishing the Marine Corps. Are you hiring? Do you know where to put your job to find the best candidates? With ZipRecruiter, you can post your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards with just one click. Then ZipRecruiter puts its smart matching technology to work for you, actively notifying qualified candidates about your job within minutes of posting, so you receive the best possible matches. That's why ZipRecruiter is different. Unlike other hiring sites, ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on the right candidate finding you. It finds the right candidate. It's no wonder 80% of employees who post on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate through the site in just one day. ZipRecruiter, the smarter way to hire. That's ZipRecruiter.com/military. One more time. Try it out for free. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/military. You can find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by growing businesses of all sizes and industries to find the most qualified job candidates with immediate results. And as mentioned before, you can try it for free by going to ZipRecruiter.com/military. Saved Rounds and Alibis. This is the portion of the podcast where I discuss questions from you, the listener, and also tie up any loose ends on other matters that we might be following that aren't covered in this current episode. The first saved round comes from a question or issue from Rosie P. Thank you, Rosie, for bringing this to my attention and to inform the listeners about this. She asks about the punishment of bread and water. That is, under the UCMJ, can a commanding officer sentence a member of the service to bread and water? Short answer is yes, he or she can. It's an authorized punishment in the sea services, that is, Navy and Marine Corps. It's a form of punishment that would be considered administrative, covered under non-judicial punishment. It can't be awarded as a punishment for a court-martial. It can only be imposed on E3s and below. Those are junior enlisted members. They must be embarked on a vessel. That means they must be part of the crew of a Navy ship or attached to the crew. And the punishment of bread and water can only last for 3 days. This came up in the news recently because of the extensive use by the CO of USS Shiloh. It's not clear exactly how many times it was used, but it appears from some of the email traffic that it was used over 15 times during his tenure as CO. So thank you, Rosie. I appreciate you bringing this up. Now on to the Bergdahl case. At the time of the recording or when you listen to this episode, the Bergdahl case is still ongoing. He most recently, at the end of October of 2017, pled guilty to misbehavior before the enemy and desertion. At this time, we are involved in the pre-sentencing portion of the case. That is, evidence put on by the government and then evidence put on by the defense before the military judge to try to sway the judge to give either more or less punishment. At this point, we are in the portion of the case where the government is putting on their case in aggravation, that is, reasons for increased punishment to be awarded by the judge. You'll recall that previously, Bergdahl and his defense team made the determination to go judge alone. That is, there will be no jury or members in this case. The judge will make the final determination. During this last week, there was extensive testimony in the form of individuals who were either injured while searching for Bergdahl or otherwise underwent tremendous hardship while searching for Bergdahl. In addition to this pre-sentencing issue, there was also a renewed unlawful command influence motion. If you want a more extensive discussion of UCI, unlawful command influence, please listen to episode 003 of Military Justice. I go through at least an hour of detail on that specific military issue. But in the current motion that is pending before the judge in the Bergdahl case, we're looking at apparent UCI. Unlawful command influence can be actual, like trying to influence either the judge or possibly a jury member, or it could be apparent. I'm not going to explain it. I will go to the case law. Quote, even if there was no actual unlawful command influence, there may be a question of whether the influence of command placed an intolerable strain on public perception of the military justice system. The test for apparent UCI is objectively focused on the perception of fairness in the military justice system as viewed through the eyes of a reasonable member of the public. An appearance of UCI arises where an objective, disinterested observer, fully informed of all of these facts and circumstances, would harbor a significant doubt about the fairness of the proceeding. That language comes from U.S. v. Salyer, which was a Navy Marine Corps case coming out of the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces a few years ago. And I'll give you an idea of what happened in Salyer and then we can see how that could apply to the Bergdahl case. In U.S. v. Salyer, that was a Marine Corps case out of Hawaii, the government disagreed with the military judge's original ruling on an issue involving child pornography. The government then went through the military judge's personnel records and obtained personal information about the age of the judge's wife and when he married his wife. It turns out that she was 17 at the time they were married, but even from the other judge's ruling in this case, there was 16 was the age of consent at the time that they were married, so there was no issue about that. The government, one of the higher-ups on the prosecution side, also called the original sitting military judge's superior. So judges in geographic areas have superior judges that usually take care of scheduling, and they write fitness reports on the other judges, etc. And so a member of the government contacted this original military judge's superior judge and expressed concerns about the military judge's ruling on that child pornography issue. So they come back on the record, and the military judge explains that all and then recuses himself, says, I can no longer sit on this case. They bring in, after that, an army colonel as the military judge, and he was brought on to finish the case. When the Salyer case finally makes it through the appellate process, the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces found that an objective member of the public would question the fairness of this case. It should be noted that there was not a question of the fairness of the second judge. It was still a question of the fairness of the overall system. By questioning the original military judge about personal issues involving, you know, when he married his wife, the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces found that the resulting perception of the military justice system would leave in the general member of the public's eye a question as to the fairness of the system. Therefore, that child pornography underlying conviction was dismissed with prejudice. So that gives you some background on apparent UCI. That means that the judge must look at, if I allow this situation to go forward, will the general public question the fairness of the system? So back to the Bergdahl case. In mid-October of 17, President Trump was asked about the Bergdahl case. I believe this was in a Rose Garden press conference, but it was a press conference nonetheless, and he replied, I think people have heard my comments in the past, unquote. It is this affirmation of his previous comments about the Bergdahl case that then Mr. Trump made during his campaign that give rise to the current pending UCI motion. Judge Nance, the sitting military judge in the Bergdahl case, in his previous denial of the defense's UCI motion in February 2017, Colonel Nance left open the possibility of the defense raising the UCI motion again if, quote, the landscape on this issue has changed, unquote. And now, if we look at the military judge's original opinion denying the UCI motion, it hinged greatly on the fact that when the statements by then Mr. Trump were made, he was just a candidate. He's a private citizen. He was expressing his views on the Bergdahl case while running for president. He wasn't the president at the time. So that's where the judge hinged a lot of his opinion on dismissing the UCI motion. You can see where the judge says, quote, apparent UCI must still be UCI. And the statements of a private citizen, even if running for president, cannot be unlawful command influence, unquote. So what we have now is a sitting president reaching back and affirming all of his prior statements about the Bergdahl case that he made while a private citizen. So at this point, as of this recording, we still don't know what the military judge is going to rule. I could see it coming down either way. This is a difficult case for the judge, and he said that, at least according to reports, during his hearings. And as soon as we get some information on that, we will make it known to you. Obviously, you can always follow me on Twitter at PodcastMJ. I try to keep you informed in between episodes by posting any new articles that come out on that Twitter feed. One other issue I should bring up is you see a lot of commentators talking about the Bergdahl case. And if you just want to express an opinion about whether or not he should be punished, I can't really take issue with that. That's fine. I mean, that really is a personal view. But one that has needed to be addressed is a commentator writing about UCI and the statements of President Trump. He wrote, quote, "Should the judge dismiss the case on those grounds being President Trump's statements, he would be saying that he lacked the faculties to make up his own mind based on the evidence," unquote. As you can see, that's clearly not the state of the law. That is someone who doesn't understand military justice, has not read the law, is unaware of the most recent opinions for the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces. So I think that it's important to take some of those statements with a grain of salt and remember who in fact it is you're reading when you listen to their comments. That's all I have for today. I really look forward to bringing you a very extensive update on the Bergdahl case in hopefully episode 031. Barring anything unprecedented, we will have a verdict by that time, and we'll also have a ruling on the UCI motion. As always, thank you for being here. Thank you for supporting the show. It's you, the listeners, are the reason I do all of this. Wyrick out. Military Justice is a production of Long Arc Digital Media. There are numerous people that need to be thanked for making Military Justice possible. First of all, audio. Those are the people that clean up all the mistakes I made. Hannah McCarthy, she takes care of that. Methil Talhan, she takes care of everything. And as always, Uber producer Dreadnought has my six.